My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, I want to thank this group, La Hacienda, you know, for asking me and entrusting me with the responsibility of coming out, sharing with you guys on a special day. You know, I really want to thank Chris for asking me to come out and for being so diligent and staying on me and making the arrangements and showing me the hospitality, and for Patty for chaperoning me and taking care of me, showing me love and doing what it is we do. I want to thank you guys who I've already met and thank those of you who I will meet. I want to thank Mickey for giving it up this morning and starting this party off right for me. You know, and now I'm doing the thanking. I feel like Denzel or something getting an Oscar, you know. I want to thank you guys, you know. And I want to do the most important thing I'll do this afternoon. I don't know who's here that's in this facility right now, and I don't know what state you're in, but I want to welcome you if you're new to the program and the fellowship that I've found that I crave. And I want to welcome you to a new beginning. I want to welcome you to a new way of living. I want to welcome you to a new life. I want to do all those things, and I don't want to do it because I'm today's speaker, and I don't say that because it's what we say when we get behind a podium. I welcome you guys, and I say that because this program, this process, and this power that I've been introduced to has been working in my life like nothing else I had discovered. Since we didn't do any readings, I'm going to assume I'm free to share with you just the way it is, because, you know, where we at is we just a meeting of some drunks and some addicts sharing together, and that's what it is I like to do. You know, my good friend Chris, I've heard a lot of Chris's tapes, and I've seen him over the years. You know, Mark is in the audience. I hear his tape. You know, when you get in the company of some people, and I know how you guys do it, and you really are coming from the book, and you really are interested in the process of recovery and the solution that's outlined in the book, and I'm tempted to get in front of you and say, I'm not going to share a long drunkologue. I just want to share about recovery. But I remember being new to the rooms, and I remember going to a meeting, and I remember a gentleman at the meeting standing in front of the group, dressed somewhat like I'm dressed today, and his hair was combed, and his eyes were bright. He was stringing sentences together real well, and I remember thinking to myself that day, I know this cat ain't been where I've been, I know he ain't felt what I felt, and I know he ain't done what I've done. What can this lame tell me? So it's real important that I let you know that the man that's standing in front of you this afternoon is not the same one that stumbled into the rooms October 11th, 1986. I'm going to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today, in the hopes that somebody will be sitting out there thinking like I was thinking. Man, I used to do the same thing. Man, I used to feel the same way. Or more important, I too want to have this thing. I'm going to give you a quick bio. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I grew up in the heart of Watts, and I come from a real large family. Listening to Mickey this morning reminds me a lot of my story, because I got an old Southern Baptist mom that pretty much raised six boys by herself. You know, I have a... We stayed in a little two-bedroom apartment. Moms and pops stayed in one room. The six boys stayed in three bunk beds in the other room. And my earliest memory of my old man was he was a drunk, and I didn't want to be like him. Now, my father wasn't violent, and my father wasn't abusive. My father was an absentee drunk, and every other Friday, like clockwork, you could count on him not showing up at the house. And it would be a little kid in the neighborhood who felt it was his duty to tell my family how my old man had been performing up at the pool hall that previous Friday or Saturday night. And I would feel ashamed, and I would feel embarrassed, and those are feelings I'm familiar with from a real early age. Pops got put out when I was 9 or 10. Mom started raising these six boys by herself. Don't know about you guys. I grew up in the early 60s, you know, and at that time, I thought ideal family life was depicted by the TV shows at the time. And the TV shows, when I grew up, they showed ideal families. Father Knows Best, Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver, My Three Sons, and Bet That Wasn't Jumping Off in My House. You know, when you're grown, you get something that's called perspective, and perspective works like this. You got a mom that raised six boys by herself. Now, at that time, my mom was on welfare, and she refused to settle for it. She put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you're grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed for her boys. But when you're a kid about 9 or 10 years old, and you bring a couple of partners home from school on a Wednesday afternoon, and mom's is in the living room with with an ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed, and you stop bringing partners home from school. And if your name is Ralph, you retreat into that fantasy world I've lived in much of my life about what life is really like for me. And really, if your name is Ralph, you start living in that prison I started living in many years ago, and I live in it sometimes even today. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. See, I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I'll do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion around. I'll wine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. You know. Don't want you to get confused about the proceedings this morning. Somebody out there is thinking to themselves right about now, this guy might be all right speaker. He's looking around the room, making eye contact with everybody. Don't let that fool you. Looking for the person whose attention is drifting. Look like you're going to sleep. I'm going to work on you, right? You'll like me before this is over, right? But to our new friends, you'll hear a lot of common themes in the rooms of recovery. And one of the themes you'll hear from a lot of our members is they never felt like they fit in. And that's not a part of my story. I'm a little guy. I like a lot of attention. I've never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. And as a result of that, I achieved and I accomplished a lot of things. My story's my story, and I'm glad to have my story. You know, if you go around this room right now, you can hear. That's one of the things that used to confuse me. If you're in the facility, and I remember being new in a recovery program, and if you're in there, you get confused about, what is a real alcoholic? What's a real addict look like anyway? You know, and people, this is the only program I ever came to where folk try to out-bottom each other. You know, and I used to like those stories, the penitentiary story. I wanted a penitentiary story, but I didn't want to serve no time, right? You know. So what's the real deal with it? You know, and there are as many different portraits of the alcoholic and addict as there are members sitting in this room right now. You know, and so, you know, I could say, yeah, I'm alcoholic because I come from a broken home. There's plenty of people sitting out there that come from two-parent homes. Yeah, I'm alcoholic because I'm a pro brother from the heart of Watts. I'm sitting out here in Hunt, Texas. Ain't none of y'all been in Watts. Most of y'all ain't been. I'm an alcoholic because, you know, I'm a short guy. There's plenty of tall guys in here. I'm alcoholic because I came from poverty and not having no money. It's folk in here that grew up with a silver spoon. You know, so that ain't why I'm alcoholic. I'm alcoholic for two reasons. One, because when I take one, I can't tell you when I'll stop. And two, because when I sincerely don't want to take one, I take another one anyway. I'm bodily and mentally different. That's it. That's all. The rest is my story. And we share our stories because somebody out there, it's going to help somebody realize, damn, I just might be one of them. Check this out. This is my story. It's the only one I have. I'm not going to get enough. I grew up, you know, and I'm a high achiever. I didn't start getting loaded early. I'm never going to be like my daddy. I'm not going to embarrass my family. I'm not going to abandon my family. I'll make my kids proud of me. Not going to be like my daddy. I'm a high achiever growing up. Every one of you guys had me in your school. I was always class president or student body president. I was a straight A student. I was teacher's pet. I played ball. I made all-stars. On the outside, it seemed like I should have been okay. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really know me, you won't like me. You know, that. Yeah, I was smart. And yeah, I was teacher's pet. And yeah, I was a straight A student. I would have traded it all in if I could have been cool. Because the neighborhood I grew up in, man, it was a whole lot more currency on being cool than being smart. Because the cats who was cool, they was in the bathroom shooting dice, smoking cigarettes, taking quarters from guys like me who brought extra quarters. And they knew how to talk to girls. You know, and girls were a mystery to me, man. And I grow up like this, man, and I'm a fast forward through this story. But I'm growing up fast track for success, high achiever. I'm growing up through high school. Check this out. You know, when I came around here four times. Somebody bring me back if I get lost. I'm getting ready to go to high school. But I'm going to go down another path for a minute. When I came to the rooms, you know, I had relapsed four times. And the way I used to go to meetings, I go to meetings, I listen to people share, because I'm a good chameleon and I'm a good mimic. I listen to a speaker share like Mickey shared this morning. I go to a meeting tonight or tomorrow. I make sure she wasn't in the room and not too many of you guys were in the room. I repeat some of the most profound things she said. I tack on or keep coming back. I'd say the program works. And I thought I claimed it because I claimed it from the podium that would make it true in my experience. Kept getting loaded, kept getting loaded, kept getting loaded. Went to a program they used to read chapter 5 from the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous at the beginning of every meeting. And I started reading the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous by myself. And I started reading it chapter 5 because that's what they did in the meetings we went to. And opening the book and starting at chapter 5 is like opening a math book and starting at the chapter on algebra. You would look good to know some addition and some subtraction first, right? You know, so but I would go and I could not see anything in common with any of you guys. And I didn't have anything I saw in the big book that meant anything to me. You know, I read Bill's story, couldn't identify, you know, Bill, older white gentleman. You know, we don't have that in common. You know, Bill said he was a veteran of foreign wars. I'm a Vietnam era draft dodger. You know, Bill talks about there had been no real infidelity. Miss me on that one, too. You know, Bill, you know, I just had a lot of he was a Wall Street stockbroker. Check out how I handle money. You know, we don't have that in common. So I just couldn't see any similarity. And I came back to the program to stay for real. And some people taught me how to read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, Ralph, the same way that you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way that you listen to our members share their stories when they get up to the podium. He said, when you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and when you listen to our members share their stories, ask yourself three or four questions. Did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? And did I do what he did? And when I read the book with those questions in mind, it came alive for me, and I found Ralph's story inside of Bill's story, because Bill talked about the drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. That's me. I proved to the world I'm somebody. I'm not my daddy. You know, Bill Jordan, you know, I had two goals when I was growing up, and I had an old Southern Baptist mom, and she instilled some things in her boys. You know, and a lot of what I share about straight A student and teachers, a lot of that wasn't virtue, it was fear of my mama. You know, I had an older brother, you know, and he used to get into things all the time. And one day a little girl came into my third grade class and said, Ralph, your mama's at the school. And I found that strange. My mother was PTA president, so she'd come up there, but she didn't need to be there on a Wednesday afternoon. And the girl went on to say, she came up to class and she went to your brother's class and whooped his ass in front of the whole class. You know, because my brother used to do things and they send notes home. And my mama said, don't send no more notes. Call when it's happening. And they called and she went, she now no trouble from the rest of us, right? And I had two goals when I was growing up. My first goal was to wear number 30 and play shortstop for the Dodgers. Maury Wills wore number 30 at that time, and he was my idol. The Dodgers were my team. Baseball was my game. And my second goal, and I meant it with everything in me, I'm going to be the first black president of the United States. And I meant that. And people used to encourage that because I was a high achiever and I was used to accomplishing things. And when I had that goal and I read Bill's story, Bill said he imagined himself the head of vast enterprises. And I identified with that kind of grandiosity because that's me. That's where I come from. And that's how I roll. So I'm growing up like that, you know, and I get to high school now. Goals, dreams and ambitions, you know, purpose driven. And I get to high school and I'm 16 years old, still ain't getting loaded. You know, I heard Mickey share about starting at 12 and saying that's late. I'm 16. I still ain't getting loaded. You know, I was a very active guy in my community, very active and politically active. And, you know, just the whole deal, man, big dreams, big goals, big hopes, big ambitions. And 16 years old, with, you know, now I get a girlfriend, my first girlfriend. You know, and I had had other girlfriends before, but this one actually knew my name, right? You know, And Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 don't mean the same thing it means for a lot of you cats. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 means this. I ran with a group of dudes that went with the same crew of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl. I waited a suitable amount of time to pass. I told him I want to go with her, and then my other boy went and asked her. Right? He came back and told me she said yes. Now I got a girlfriend, right? I don't know what to do with her because Ralph don't do girls. And, you know, every now and then I carry her books home, maybe go to the show on the weekends. This particular night, me and my girl go out on a double date. I'm with an older partner of mine. Him and his girl are in the front seat. Me and my girl in the back seat go to a drive-in movie. Plastic cup of rum and coke come to the back seat this particular night, and I drank that rum and coke down, went down real warm, rushed back to the top of my brain. All of a sudden, Ralph's hand started doing things they had never done. Mouth started saying things it had never said, and I had arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know. Gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be, and say without it. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about me in a lot of places. And it starts talking about me in the front. Our new friends and you guys that go through here, I know Chris takes you through this all the time. That chapter, The Doctor's Opinion, has a line in there that goes something like this. Men and women, I like to think like, drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. Now, I recognized that line the first time I saw it. Because unlike some of you guys, you know, you drink drink that Johnny Walker or that Jack Daniels. You know, I don't be scrunching my face up, chasing it, but I like what it did when it went down. You know, I'm not overnight alcoholic. I understand this disease being progressive in nature because that's how it showed up in my experience. I drank that night that rum and coke and it went down real warm, did what it did, and I like what it did. And that's how my drinking stayed. I didn't get drunk, and I didn't get drunk for a long time. My drinking for a time stayed just on weekends, just to party. You know, I hear a lot of people that go back in the, you know, it filled up an emptiness, and I was a youngster at 16 years old. It was the thing to do when you rolling with a crew that's got it like that. It's just what you did when you 16 coming up in school. And I was a square that didn't want to, you know, outside I always been a square, and inside of me I always been this freak wanting to break out, you know. And that's a cold place to be. And alcohol let me break out. But, you know, I'm just cool with it, and I'm just drinking. And my drinking stayed that way for a time. And I graduated from high school in 71, and I graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. In 71, when I started college, I was still drinking just on the weekends to go to parties. By the end of 71, I'm drinking not only on the weekends to go to parties, but now I'm drinking to get ready for the parties. By 72, I'm drinking on the weekends, and I'm drinking during the week after class, and I've added some non-addictive marijuana to the mix. By the end of 72, I'm drinking, I'm smoking herb, and I'm selling herb. By 1973, I'm drinking, I'm smoking herb, I'm selling herb, I'm doing cocaine and other drugs, I'm doing it on a daily basis, and you could not have told me it was anything wrong with the way that I was living. The big book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false. And the way that worked for me was this. In the way that I'm doing it, isn't that the way everybody does it? Why would you be young with a bright future, with a little bit of money? I was getting financial aid. Didn't chasing women and getting loaded come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, wasn't coming over your house no more. For what? Didn't have nothing to discuss. You know, and I'm going to make a statement, and I don't mean to offend our young friends. I don't mean our new friends. I mean our young friends. I don't mean to offend you, but I'm glad I grew up and came up in the time and the era that I came up in. See, I'm from an era where you go to concerts and you pass shit to your neighbor. You don't even have to know him. You just pass it. You know, I come up in a time and a place. And I don't know. You know, it's a lot of people I'm looking around the room that's from my age. I don't know if it was a simpler time, but it seemed like a simpler time. You know, in 2006, you got to worry about sexually transmitted diseases, safe sex. Hey, back in those days, man, I'd go to a club. I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next. I don't need to know where you work, your sign. I really don't need to know your last name. Let's get to the basis of this relationship. Do you get loaded the way I get loaded? Because that's the way we're going to be. That's the way we do it, man. And I got out of school, and I can't tell you how I made it. I made it out of college, and I started working at a job that should have allowed me to acquire things normal people acquire. I never did that. I never did that, man. You know, snapshot of Ralph's life, this is when drugs and alcohol was working. I would buy a car and make exactly 3 car payments, then come find it. First time I had a car repossessed, I had the nerve to call the police and report it stolen. Hadn't paid a note in 9 months, right? And I'm calling, I want to report a stolen car. And they did what they do, and look, no, Mr. White, the rightful owner just came and got there, you know? And I'm like, okay, I got used to it for the other ones. You know, I'm the kind of brother never had a problem balancing a bank book. Payday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. Zero. No problem balancing my bank book. I stayed in the crib from 1976 to 1979 without paying rent. Couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from, and one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with drugs and alcohol until I'm free of them. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that are crystal clear to me now, looking in the rearview mirror of experience, were not at all clear to me when I was going through them. Can't tell you the moment, can't tell you the hour, can't tell you the day or the time, can't tell you what I was doing or where I was when alcohol and drugs ceased to be a luxury for me and became a necessity. Talk about the invisible line. It seemed like one day I'm over here sitting in the rooms, going in places in suits, and they invite me in the back room. And seemed like the very next day I'm sitting out here in the room with about this many of you guys. You know, when you go up in a spot and when you fat and you got money and you steal somebody, she calls you and lets you go in the special room. And then as time passes, you end up in the room with the sweat. I come from them kind of places. Some of y'all don't know what I'm talking about, but I come from them kind of places. The places where you sit and I don't know when that happened. I would look at somebody like you and say, if I ever get like him, I quit. I look at you and be like, man, shit, you look like you need to get some help. You know, in the book, Luke talks about seeking the Lord. Can anybody else play the regret game in Alcoholics Anonymous? Okay. The regret game go like this. If I only knew then what I know now, I never would have took that for, yeah, right. You know, remind me of a story about a little boy named Johnny. And Johnny had a habit his father used to frown on. Johnny used to like to play with himself. And his father came home from work early one day. Little Johnny's bedroom door was closed. Father opens the door without knocking. Sure enough, little Johnny's in the bedroom masturbating. Father looks at him and says, son, I thought I told you if you keep doing that, you'll go blind. And Johnny stopped and looked up at his daddy and said, well, daddy, can I just do it till I need glasses? You know it. I like that story because that story reminds me of me in the life. I see you going down, you going down, you go. I'm just going to do it till I need. Right. And wasn't long before I became the Lord compared. We don't have enough time for me to tell you all the stories that should have been signs along the way. I got married in 1980 on a Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock. I had a bachelor party the night before my wedding. None of the guys at my bachelor party are getting married the next day. All of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm still at my bachelor party till 7:30, me and my brothers. Four of us made it to this program, right? They take me home at 7:30. They pour me in the bed. You know, they get me up at 10 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm toe up, man. I just laid on the bed. You know, I still go to meetings 19 and a half years later for a lot of reasons, a whole lot of reasons. One of the main reasons I still go to meetings in life is because you can talk shorthand. You know, my friend Strange always likes to say you can't describe the taste of a banana. You have to be more. You know, and you guys just know, you know, all I got to do is say, yeah, I laid on the bed, I was toe up. And people, yeah, you know, I know, head, you know, throwing up your stomach lining and, you know, just that whole deal, you know, I'm toe up. And so I laid on the bed and they get me up at 10 o'clock and they get me ready for my 1 o'clock wedding. And I'm supposed to say my own vows at this wedding, right? Show up. My then wife-to-be looked at me wobbling in, and she looked at the preacher. She said, scratch the own vows. Say the regular on him now, right? So now my lines are cut to two words, and we end the ceremony. It gets to me. I get ready to say I do. I say I and threw up all over. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, to our new friends, if you're anything like me, when I came around the rooms, you guys were saying words, and I was familiar with the words, but the way you guys used them was not the way I used them in my everyday walk around vocabulary. You guys were talking about this psychic change and this phenomenon of craving and this allergy of the body, you know, and I needed some help with some of that. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over and over again. Because I got to let you know that that wedding day was the high point of that marriage. It went downhill after that. Because I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband, remember, sitting on my living room couch. Wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up, going to the dining room table, picking her purse up off the table, clutching it real close to her. She went back to the bathroom, and I feel this tall because nobody else was in the house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband, remember coming home and sticking my key in the door. Wife and two-year-old daughter sitting right here and they crying. I look over here and homeboy sitting in my seat with a gun pointing at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. Let me talk to the men for just a minute. Don't know about the rest of you fellas, but I always had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a father? Do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because if you're in the life, your track record already give you your answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide. And it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas, laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night, knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you're the one bringing the wolf to the door. See, my house got broken into 4 times. 4 times I pretended to call a local police station, and 4 times I knew I was playing a game with myself. Because they had told me, you're going to give us our money or we're going to come up in there and get it. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband, remember sitting on my back porch. 2-year-old daughter coming outside, pulling at my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. I remember stopping and giving her a little grin, talking about, don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter. I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. I've already shared with you guys that my disease is progressive in nature, and my experience is progressive in a couple of areas. Shared one area already. It takes more than it used to take in order for me to get the same effect. But my disease is progressive in another area, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. I'm willing to do more readily than I used to be willing to do to chase this thing. First time I went in my wife's purse, you could have hooked me to a poly too. And when I said I wasn't stealing this money, I meant it and I would have passed. I'm going to replace this $40 before she knows it's missing. And I mean it because I don't steal. The line keep moving when you're in the life. First, I don't steal. Then I don't steal from my family. Then I don't steal from my wife. Then I don't steal. That line keeps on moving. And when I went in that purse that first time, man, I meant it. Replace this money before she knows it's missing. Went out, spent that 40. Came home, looked for her purse. She had moved it. I couldn't believe I had hit it. Didn't look too hard. Laid down, said, I got to replace it before she knows it's missing. 2 weeks later, the same scenario presented itself. Got paid, gave her some money, went out doing what I do. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, written in 1939, saw me coming in 1986. Line in there describes me. We don't know why, but the alcoholic could be unable to recall with sufficient force pain, suffering, humiliation weeks or days ago. That vow I made to replace that money 2 weeks later when I got paid, came home and looked for that purse. Didn't deliberate so long before I hit it this time. In fact, it was replaced with a bright idea. Instead of replacing the money, this idea replaced that thought. Last time, I took $40 out the purse and came back looking for the purse and she had moved it. This time, I'll take all the money out of the purse, and that I don't spend, I'll sneak it back in the purse. And I was off and running to hit my wife's purse on a regular basis. She started sleeping with it up under the pillow. That wasn't enough for me. Something about laying in bed with that feeling on you, knowing the money is just an arm's length away. Right, and I'd be laying in the bed, and I'd let that real regular breathing set in, and I'd let it set in a while. Crawl out my side of the bed, crawl on her side, go up under that pillow, and I come out real slow. Put the purse in front of me, creep out the bedroom, jump out the front door, jump in my car, coast out the driveway, I'm gone. It's Wednesday, I come back Monday. Did that one too many Wednesdays, came back one Monday, a note was on the screen door, the rest of your stuff is at your mama's house, suitcase on the porch, I'm now kicked out my house, I'm now my daddy. Went to stay at my mom's house over the course of that ensuing year. My 5 brothers got kicked out of their respective homes and all 6 of us ended up in my mama's house, drinking and smoking. Days there were, between the 6 of us, we couldn't come up with $5. Highlight of my day during this particular time period got to the point because my mom had changed locks so many times. You know, I read Bill's story and he talks about Lois coming home from the department store to find him drunk. And my mother would come home every single day with a bag of groceries. Because if she didn't, these 6 grown leeches she gave birth to would have cleaned her refrigerator out on a daily. And she came home and the highlight of my day at this time, she changed her locks. Was when the van pool would pick her up to go to work, 6:30 in the morning. We had rigged the bars on one of her windows. Me and one of my brothers would climb through the window, open the front door for the rest of us, and we'd have a place we could post up till 4:30 when she came home. When I first got put out the house, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man she married. She used to bring my daughter over on Saturday afternoons so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. Like you, Mickey, I feel you. Because I really, really, really wanted to be a daddy to my little girl. I really, really did. I wanted to take my little girl to Disneyland and Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand in my big hand and just take her to the store and buy her ice cream. I wanted to sit her in my lap and read her stories. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and give her a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in this fellowship get since I've been here. The look like, this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like I'm going to the store to get Rain some ice cream. Disappeared. It's Saturday. I come back Monday. I sneak back Sunday night when her mom was picking her up. And I remember some of them long Sunday nights, man, sticking my head around the side of my mom's house, looking at those headlights and those two heads sitting in the car, man, and then through the tears thinking to myself, there go my life backing out this driveway. And I've heard a lot of people say they were scared of dying out there. That ain't my story. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I am so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on October 11th in 1986, I got miserable enough and I got tired enough. I got directed to my fourth program, recovery. I went to the Harbor Life Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. And on October the 13th, they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I went to that recovery home, I was full of guilt. I was full of remorse. I was full of shame. I was full of, I'll never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done and what I had become. I only share with you guys the tip of the iceberg. Didn't share with you when I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, started stealing out my mom's purse. Didn't share with you when I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house. Check came to one of my little brothers in the name of R. White. All of us are R. White. Stole that. Didn't share with you when my grandmother gave me a $200 to buy a plane ticket to the family reunion. If it wasn't for my mom, my grandmother never would have saw Atlanta, Georgia. Didn't share with you the first time I tried to get sober. My ex-wife got me a job at her job. I stole $1,600 from them and ruined her reputation in that industry. Didn't share with you a lot. Suffice it to say, I had a lot on my tip when I came, and I was full. I'd never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done. And on October the 13th, I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a gentleman was standing up in front of the group, somewhat like I'm standing up in front of the group now. And he was sharing about taking from the family, and he was sharing about taking from the job. And I remember sitting out there and thinking to myself, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that shit. I'm different. Y'all ain't gonna hear my business. And the speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room and was reading my mail. He dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. And he caught my attention. He went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, the better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope at that first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting I went to. He described to me what I suffer from, that it's something physically different about me. And I was sitting up in the front and seemed like he was talking directly to me. It felt like he said to me, Ralph, don't take my word for it. Diagnose yourself. Look at your own experience. How many times did you say, I'm just going to spend 20? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going to stop off at happy hour? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going over here to my boy's house? What happened? Whole paycheck. Ralph, did it happen once? Did it happen twice? If your name is Ralph, every 2 weeks from 1979 to 1985, whole paycheck. Not the book, not your, not my sponsors, not yours, my experience. My experience abundantly confirms to me when I take one anything, no matter what I have to do, who I have to see, where I have to go, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over and I have to have another. Okay, Ralph, smart guy, if it's just my body, how do you explain stone sober? My car seemed to drive to the LIQ or the dope house on payday. Second part of this disease, the mental obsession. The obsession that somehow, someday, I'll be able to control and enjoy that magic potion I discovered oh so many years ago. That's a cold obsession to have and a cold delusion to be in if your name is Ralph. Control and enjoy. Where does that come from? Because anytime I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying. And anytime I was enjoying, I damn sure wasn't controlling. Why am I obsessed with control and enjoy? I can't drink because of my body. I can't stop because my mind refuses to accept that fact. I'm powerless. Third part of this disease, spiritual malady. 12 and 12 sometimes calls that a soul sickness. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental and the physical will straighten out. That's what we do in these rooms. That's what it is we do. don't put too much on it, and don't get too scared, and don't get intimidated. I'm a person that talks a lot about the book. I'm a person that talks a lot about the process. I'm a little person who talks a lot about this program, person who talks a lot about the fellowship that I crave. And more than I talk about all those, to the best of my ability, man, I'm a guy that try to live them one day at a time. And the reason why it started out, because I'm desperate, and I started for my life. You know, the reason that you got the speaker in front of you this afternoon that you got in front of you is not because it's chic to be sober in 2006, not because it's the right thing to do to be sober. I did it because I'm desperate and I do it for my life. And I did it because I had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life. As I had come to believe that I was just going to be just that way. And it was going to be the same after the same after the same after the same. You see, I hear a lot of people sharing about, you know, I had come to believe I was going to die. I am going to die. My question is, how do I want to live before I die? You know, and what? But if you come from the life I come from, if you come from the life I come from, dying's preferable. What scared me wasn't I was going to die. What scared me is I was going to keep living dead. See, I come from a real dark place. I come from walking the streets at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning with nowhere to go. I'm one of them. I'm one of the ones that went all the way down the line. I'm one of the ones that were already familiar with rooms like this with people like you. But the rooms I was in didn't have no electricity. The rooms I was in, if you looked in the refrigerator, they had room temperature water sitting in the refrigerator. The rooms I was in, they wasn't saying keep coming back. The rooms I was in, when you ran out of money, it was like, get your ghost smelling ass up out of here. You know, the rooms I was in, and I went all the way. I don't know if you come from that dark place. You know, and I made it to the rooms of recovery. And the men and women in the fellowship loved me and nursed me back to health. Gave me a solution, a way out upon which we can all agree. Said something I found real curious at the time I started coming. They said, let us love you till you can love yourself. Did not believe that one. Didn't believe it. Not where I had come from. Not where I had gone. Last 2 years of my getting loaded, never looked at myself full face in the mirror, never. Took glancing looks, I stumped. How you gonna tell me you'll love me? You turn your back on me, I'm liable to go in your purse right now. How you gonna tell me you'll love me? I stink. And that was before I knew what happens in the rooms of recovery. That was before I knew what happens when the God in you reaches out to the God in me. That was before I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous we specialize in loving unlovable people. And you love me and you nursed me back to health. You gave me some steps. Step one, admitted that I'm powerless over alcohol, and for me and over drugs in my life, it become unmanageable. I did the work on step one when I was out there. I don't have to come into the rooms and decide that I'm going to be powerless. Drugs and alcohol decided that for me. I came into the rooms, and I got with the sponsor, and I got with some people who had a working knowledge and experience with that book, and they started sharing with me so that I could clearly see what my experience had been. Step one is the problem, and it's a conclusion I draw based on my experience. Step two, that's the solution. See, lack of power is my dilemma. What's my solution? I need some power. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. I also did the work on step two when I was out there. I tried to get sober for my wife. I tried to get sober for my daughter. I tried to get sober for my mama. I tried to get sober for the job. You couldn't stop me. I couldn't stop me. If it ain't a power bigger than me that could stop me, I'm in big trouble. I took step two out of desperation, and I took step two out of what do I have to lose. Step two is a conclusion I draw based on my experience also. Step two is the solution. Steps 3 through 12, the 10-step program action to get me to the solution. Step 3, made a decision to turn my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of God as I understood him. Told my sponsor at that time, how am I going to do that? I don't understand God. He said, it ain't but two things you need to know in order to start this program. Number one, he is. Number two, he ain't you. And from that beginning, all sorts of remarkable things have started to happen in my life. I get the opportunity to work with a lot of men and women. I'm not one of these don't guys. don't go around these kind of people, don't get into these relationships, don't do this, don't do that. Go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do get a sponsor who has working knowledge and experience with the Big Book and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous with somebody who has experience with that book. Do apply the steps to your life to the best of your ability right where you are right now. Do work with another alcoholic. Do get in touch with a God of your understanding and do whatever the hell you want to do. This program is about living. It ain't about losing. And my life has been so full, and my life has been returned, and my life has been restored. And the reason that you guys had a speaker in front of you today is because if it wasn't working for me, I wouldn't be the one up here doing it. I'm not the one that comes with the message of fear. If you go back out there, it's still kicking at. You know, I told you guys at one time it was kind of okay for me. And I remember when I thought it was going on, people used to look at me the way I was doing it and be like, damn, man, ain't you scared of overdose? And I'd be like, overdose? I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better put some more shit up on my... So, you know, the message that a whole alcoholic of my variety is not, you know, not the message of fear. The book talks about a message that's got to have depth and that's got to have weight. And the message that this brother brings to you guys today that's got the most depth and the most weight is you looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You looking at a guy who at 33 years old had not answered anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake-up call to go to work. I no longer thought I was employable. You looking at a guy who at 33 years old was sleeping in the back of his mother's garage. You looking at a guy who's a graduate of a major university in this country, and my job at the end of my drinking and using was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old dope dealer. You looking at a guy who was sleeping in the back of his mother's garage, eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast, didn't know where my family lived, didn't know what school my little girl was enrolled in. You looking at a guy who made it to the rooms of recovery, and I was and the men and women in the fellowship, this fellowship, the fellowship I crave, gave me a way out upon which we could all agree. If you're sitting in here right now and you think this program is just about not drinking and just about not using, you're shortchanging the program and you're shortchanging yourself. What this program is about a whole lot more than that. I'm not knocking physical sobriety. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might make it home with a whole paycheck. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might stop going to jail on the weekends. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might make it to work on Monday morning. But what this program has to offer is a whole lot more than that. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that does for me what I can't do for myself. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that can do anything but fail. What this program is really about, somebody is like me. Somebody needs to see a program. You know, I got a friend up in Canada, Lou, and Lou says Alcoholics Anonymous is a program that walks, talks, and shakes hands. If you really want to know what this program is about, take a look around this room right now. See the program in action. What this program is really about is about taking people like us, drunks and dope fiends and hustlers and boosters and prostitutes and tricks, child abusers, wife abusers, failures as parents, failures as kids, broken down pieces of men and women who don't have dreams and goals and hopes anymore. This program takes people like us and puts us together in one room. And I stick one hand in your hand, another hand in God's hand, and we pick up our beds and we walk out of these rooms as mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, sisters, brothers, employees, employers, role models in our community. You know, this. This program is about growth. This program is about change. If it's to be any changes made in my life, it begins and it ends with me. I'm not one of the ones that talks about wait 5 years for the fog to lift. Thank God Bill and Dr. Bob didn't wait 5 years for the fog to lift. I can start growing and changing just as fast as I'm willing to work for it. And I got involved in this deal, man. And I'm one of the ones, you know, I really don't trip about a whole lot of things, you know. I love the life that I live, you know. And I'm very serious about this program, and I'm very serious about recovery. And, you know, I used to think you have to demonstrate that in an hour display. I used to go to meetings of me gritting my teeth, and when people would laugh at the speaker, I'd look around like, ain't nothing funny, you know, and I didn't understand it ain't about show, it's about tell. I'm all about, you know, I'm never about substance, I'm all about the show and the fact, you know, and this program, man, I'm serious in about this program, but I'm not at all serious in this program all the time. If you ain't laughing in this program, you ain't taking this program serious enough. We did way too much crying already, man. This is the easier softer way. This is the reason you got today's speaker in front of you, because I love the life that I live today, and you can have the same too. You know, 13 years ago this September, I walked down the aisle. Another woman found me worthy. I got all the way down the aisle this time. I got the I do out, and I even had the pictures to prove it. You know, After the first speaker spoke this morning, after Mickey spoke, I had to make it up there because the cell ain't working down here. And I do what I do whenever I go somewhere, either before or right after. I call the house. And there's an 11-year-old little girl who answered the phone. And that 11-year-old little girl has never seen her daddy loaded, and one day at a time, she never will. And I go out of town a lot on business and in the fellowship, and I go to meetings a lot at home. And every time I leave home and I give that girl a kiss, I never see the flicker in her eye. Like, I wonder if daddy's coming home. She don't know that guy. Daddy's always home. She don't know that guy. Don't mean a lot to somebody, but it means the world to everybody sitting up in here. Somebody in there know what it's like to be a next year daddy and a next year mama. You know the kind. On Christmas and on birthdays, sitting around somewhere away from the family, you look at your watch, or if you like me, you look at the sun and you think to yourself, damn, next year I'm going to get that girl something. And as a result of this program, this process, and this power, for the last 19 and a half birthdays, Christmases, and 19 and a half every days in between, I've been a this year daddy. I've been a this year daddy. And I owe that to this program. The 2-year-old whose piggy bank I was going in, we took her to dinner on Wednesday night. She turned 23 years old. And at that dinner, we started planning her graduation. She graduates from UCLA next month. And I had my big girl sitting directly across the table from me, and I had my little girl sitting to my right, and my ex-wife, who I threw up on the right hand or across the table, and my current wife on the left. And I got the looks from my girls, like, this is my daddy and this is my hero. And you guys gave me something. That was a result of an 8 and a 9. Didn't amends with that ex-wife when I was a year and a half sober, and I've continued to live in amends with her ever since. She's one of my best friends. When her husband was dying, I went and stayed with her for about a week when he was dying of cancer. That's what you guys gave me. Remember one Sunday morning, my mother coming out of her bedroom on her way to church. Sunday morning, about November 1987. Her living room was full of drunks. And my mother made it to the living room on her way out the front door. And she stopped and she looked at these drunks. And with tears in her eyes, she said, I want to thank you for my sons. Because these drunks were sitting around her living room table with these blue books open in front of them. And my two brothers and I have been inspired by a group in L.A. We had seen them at a meeting, and they had done something about this. And they had made that book come alive in a way I had never heard or seen, in a 2-hour marathon meeting. And we approached some people from that group and asked them if they'd do the same thing with us. And we started meetings at my mom's house around her dining room table back in 1987. A group called the Never Too Early Big Book Workshop. There were about 12 of us then. They'll be meeting tomorrow morning in Los Angeles at a facility. It's about 250 now. And I don't say that, man, because, you know, I'm out there somewhere. I know I am. I'm out there. Somebody out there is thinking they can't wait to be the speaker at Alumni Day, or they can't wait to be a speaker at a committee. You know, I remember because, yeah, I could do better than that guy right there. If he can speak, I know I can. I know you can, too. But, you know, one day at a time. Don't trip. You know, somebody out there is thinking, because I remember thinking that, and somebody's thinking, damn, that guy must work a hell of a program. Listen to the way he's sharing it. Somebody else is thinking to themselves, I'll never be able to get this thing. I'll never be able to share in front of people like that. Can I have this thing? And check this out. What I'm doing right now is talking about the program of recovery, and it really ain't got a whole lot to do about living it. This is a living program, man, and it's within the reach and it's within the grasp of anybody sitting in this place right now. You know, I am so glad that I got directed to a program, and God don't make too hard of turns with those who seek him. Don't get twisted what it is we do. I always wanted to be important. I always wanted to do something significant. I always wanted to leave my mark on the world. And check out what it is we're doing right now. I'm going to get ready to get down from here. But you know, every now and then I'm moved to think about it. I heard Mickey talking about grace. When grace comes calling, and he comes calling on us, we and you know, and I'm not one of the ones that talks about the chosen fruit, you know, because to me that means God is choosing and God is, no, you know, we the ones who choose, you know, I choose that you, I was walking to a meeting one day and I walked up on an old timer and he said, and I had about 6 months, and he said, Ralph, how you doing? What's up with you? And I said, oh, just doing God's work. And he said, what you think you can do for God? God can't do for himself. Floored me, stopped me in my tracks. I'm telling you, ain't that the right answer? Because I like giving right answers, right? You know, ain't that the right answer? And I said, well, tell me, what is this deal that we do? And he said, Ralph, check this out. Your job is to do for God's kids. God's job is to do for you. He gave you something he didn't even reserve for himself. He gave you something he don't even have. I said, I have something God don't have? What is that? He said, he gave you the power to choose whether you're going to return his love. God don't have no choice. He is love. He got to love you. You get to choose whether to return. And from that moment to this, my whole attitude and outlook on that whole deal changed. My job is to do for God's kids. And when we're in these meetings and when we're in these rooms, we're uniquely qualified to do something can't nobody else do. If God himself had walked up to me on October 11, 1986, I would have thought it was a flashback from some mushrooms or something. Oh, shit. And I'd have been loaded another 3 months off just that one. You know, I needed a drug. I needed a smoker. I needed somebody like me just roll up on me October 1986. That's what we do. Each one teach one. That's what it is we do. Whenever anybody anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to be there. And for that, I'm responsible. I'm so grateful for the people who kept the light on for me. And I just want to leave this place a little bit better than the way I found it. And we are, you, every time we go, think about what it is we do. Think about how it is that we qualify. And all you need is experience to qualify in this place, man. You don't need no hell of a man. You don't need no, just have some experience and share that. Stick to that. And when we in these rooms right now, something's going on here, right now. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, some little boy or some little girl is getting ready to have mama come back home. Every time I go to a meeting, some family getting ready to welcome daddy home. Every time you and me go to a meeting, some couple getting ready to be reunited. Every time we go to a meeting, some employer that I don't know and could care less about getting ready to have a hell of an employee come in the workplace, who wouldn't want to be part of a fellowship like that? Always wanted to be somebody important and do something special and significant. Can think of nothing more important and nothing more significant than to be a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. Could talk about it all day. I used to go share and talk to people, my sponsor. If it's a lot of new people, you know, should I talk about God? He said, Ralph, if talk of God scare anybody up out of there, some shit in the street that'll scare their ass right back up in there. You just talk about what it, you know, so I just have to talk about what it is that has brought this man to you guys right now. And 19 and a half years straight, I'm still as grateful as the day I came. I'm not one that says, I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why it is I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, it's my gift to God. My name is Ralph White, and I am an alcoholic.